and the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He is also the author of the new book, Living and Dying on the Factory Floor, From Outside In and the Inside Out. The event is also sponsored by the Institute of Anarchist Studies and the Burgerville Workers Union. Again, that's Lessons for a New Generation of Organizers, a talk with David Rainey on Thursday, May 16th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ascony Union Hall, 6025 East Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Next up is Between the Covers with host David Naiman talking to Christina Rivera Garza, who's the author of the new detective novel, The Taiga Syndrome. KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is writer, poet, translator, and critic Christina Rivera Garza. Rivera Garza is the author of 6 novels, 3 collections of short stories, 5 collections of poetry, and 3 books. She's the only author who has won the Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz Prize 2 times, in 2001 for her novel Nadie Me Verá Llorar, and in 2009 for her novel La Muerte Me Da. She is also the winner of the German Anna Segers Prize and the French Roger Caillois Award for Latin American Literature. Christina Rivera Garza is Distinguished Professor in Hispanic Studies at the University of Houston and instrumental in starting the first Spanish language creative writing PhD program in the United States there. Rivera Garza studied urban sociology at the National Autonomous University of Mexico and earned a doctorate in Latin American history at the University of Houston with a dissertation on La Castañeda, Mexico's most infamous mental hospital, and the social history of mental illness in early 20th century Mexico. Rivera Garza is the translator of writers from Juliana Spar to Don Miche into Spanish, as well as the books Notes on Conceptualism by Vanessa Place and Robert Fitterman, and The Undercommons by Fred Moten and Stefano Harney. Yet despite being one of the best-known writers in Mexico today, having won 6 of Mexico's highest literary awards, and with Carlos Fuentes calling Nadie Me Verá Llorar as not only one of the most perturbing and beautiful novels ever written in Mexico, but one of the most notable works of fiction in the literature of the Spanish-speaking world at the start of the 21st century, Rivera Garza's work is just now being considered and discussed in the Anglophone world, with 2 translations of her work in the last year. The Iliac Crest, out from Feminist Press, translated by Sarah Booker, and the book she's here to discuss today, The Taiga Syndrome, out from Dorothy Books, translated by Suzanne Jill Levine and Aviva Kena, with starred reviews from Publishers Weekly and Kirkus, and picked by the BBC as one of the best books of 2018. National Book Award-winning poet Daniel Bezertsky says the following of Rivera Garza's latest book in English. If the Taiga Syndrome is a book of illness, it's also about exile, disappearance, borders, love, language and translation, desire, capitalism and its discontents, fairy tales, and what it means to be possessed by the madness of others and the madness of ourselves. The murmurs that haunt the detective in The Taiga Syndrome evoke the history of Mexican fiction, most notably Juan Rulfo, but this is not a religious state of purgatory. It's more like Apocalypse Now, fused with the worlds of Clarice Lispector and Jorge Luis Borges. In other words, there is no one writing novels as phantasmagorically exquisite as Christina Rivera Garza's The Taiga Syndrome, which is both quietly poetic and narratively unhinged, a crucial addition to her distinguished oeuvre. Welcome to Between the Covers, Cristina Rivera Garza.
Hello, I'm so happy to be here.
So on the surface, at least, The Taiga Syndrome is about a failed ex-detective who has turned to writing noir mystery novels, but nevertheless is sort of drawn out of retirement and takes the case of a man who wants to find the woman who left him, who disappeared into the taiga, the boreal forest, with another man never to return. But it doesn't really feel like that is what The Taiga Syndrome is about, even though that's, I think, a pretty accurate description of the plot. So perhaps we could begin with the questions that animated the project for you, or the circumstances or impulses or desires.
Yeah, no. I think you're absolutely right. What you described is essentially the plot. But I have never believed that plot is the most important component of a novel. It's one of them. It's obviously relevant. But novels or writing projects, more generally speaking, are made of many other operations. And so what I would have to say here is that my female nameless detective is being with me now through several books. So I have another novel and three or four long short stories in which she's been leading the whole exploration, the exploration that relies on plot, but also the linguistic and more the larger exploration of the book. And in this case, I would say that I was very interested in exploring the possibility of moving as far away as I could, in terms of linguistically speaking, in terms of the human search that is at the core of every single writing project, I suppose. And so I wanted to move far away. I wanted to know how far away I could go while being still legible. So if you are really moving away, if you are really trying to cross as many borders as you can, there is going to be a point in which you will become illegible, right? And as someone who likes to take risks in terms of my writing projects, I want to move and explore new territories, but at the same time, I want to make sure that I have a reader with me, that I have an accomplice, a companion with me, and that obviously implies that I have to be still legible. So I wanted to test those waters, and I suppose that's one of the reasons why I chose this landscape. This geography, this territory, the taiga, for someone who, I was writing this novel in between Mexico City and San Diego, so someone who is in this area of the world, perhaps the taiga is what appears to be more, as far away as you can go. And so that's the initial, I would say, impulse, or the question that I had in mind. Yeah.
Well, I would love to explore some of the ways in which you have us cross borders of language and linguistics. So, I mean, because I feel like one of the ways you could look at this book is it's a book about language.
Yes.
Or more specifically about the translational aspects of communication and signification.
Yeah.
Because everything that we experience goes through multiple levels of mediation. And thus we have to sort of question the authenticity of everything that comes to us as a reader. But I also think the characters in a way have to question what they're receiving as characters. So the most obvious way this is true is with the relationship between the detective and the translator that the detective hires to be able to speak to the native inhabitants of the taiga. You have this wonderful line about the translator that goes, "He chose to use the language that we would speak during our journey through the boreal forest, a language that was not strictly his nor mine, a third space, a second tongue in common." And so in this sense, we don't just rely on the translator to carry meaning across the divide between a language foreign to the detective and her own, but into a shared language that neither one of them actually speak as their primary language. So the language that they're operating in is not the primary language of either character. So tell us why you wanted this setup and what that setup does, what that setup provides for you in the story.
Yeah, what an interesting question. You know, very often we go through, when you're watching movies, and they take place in foreign countries that obviously speak a different language, a language other than your own. Very often we act, there is this silent pact. Like, we are supposed to act as though communication is just achievable. That is, it's going to be somehow smooth and clear. And it seems to me that in many situations that we go through in life, the case is just the opposite. That even if we speak the same language, we need mechanisms able that allow us to translate the experience of others to our own experience, right? And in this novel, I wanted to make sure that all these different levels of mediation and different levels of negotiation in between languages were a central component of the novel. So as much as we spoke about plot at the beginning, but I wanted this mediation to be sort of the main protagonist of the novel. And that's one of the reasons, in addition to the presence of the translator and the description of how slow and how complicated and the many layered process that translating involves, I wanted to be sure that the readers knew that this novel, in fact, was also going through a very complicated mediating process. And that's one of the reasons why I chose to start most of many paragraphs with the word that, que. In Spanish, which is a sign of indirect speech. So we when we use that, we know that there is someone else involved, that there has been another presence and someone else's intervention and interpretation in whatever I'm saying or whatever the character is saying. And I wanted the reader to be able to listen to these different echoes and the possibility that these other participations were tainted, deforming, informing too, but somehow reshaping what the characters were going to be understanding and therefore how they were going to be reacting to whatever they were going through. So that adds a level of complexity that I wanted to bring to the novel, because it's the level in which I'm asking the readers, you are the next step. Your interpretation is as valid as the ones that we are going to be discussing here in this book. And it's not going to be easy, right? You're going to have to risk something too.
Yeah, I love that take on it. Could we hear a little bit? I marked out a little bit of a section about the translator, and I was hoping maybe you'd read a little section
this
for us.
This one? Perfect. Yeah. Let me see. I remember how many times I repeated the same phrase, tongue to tongue, a speaker of their tongue who could translate everything into my tongue. A smile, no, a laugh, a look of intrigue or distress, a sigh or something more serene. In the report I would write for the man who had two wives, I would ask him to take into account that nothing had happened exactly as I claimed. I would tell him that nothing happens as it is written, and I would constantly repeat this or something like it. I would ask him in a careful and tactful way, assuming that he knew, but realizing also that these types of things are always hard to bear in mind, to take into account that there was a great distance between speech and writing. Take your time, I would remind him. Read as if there were many minutes, even hours, between the words spoken and the ones written down, transcribed, the phrases. I could tell him, for example, when I wrote, I asked them if they had electricity and they responded by showing me a lit candle, that he should realize I had in fact pronounced a question, but before I received the answer, which came much later, the translator had made me repeat the question several times, and then had said it several times himself, until the inhabitants of the village in the taiga would understand it and answer. And then we had to wait, translator, inhabitants, myself, until the action, showing the candle and articulating the words, "We don't have electricity," was heard and understood, first with surprise, and then, finally, disbelief.
We've been listening to Cristina Rivera Garza read from The Taiga Syndrome from Dorothy Books. So even before the detective mentions the act of translation, she talks about a great distance between speech and writing, which suggests that this is true even when there's no actual translator involved, that this distance exists even when there's no negotiation between two languages. Now we're negotiating between speech and writing. And you mentioned earlier when you were talking about translation about also this translational aspect of just communication, even if we're in the same language.
Yeah.
So, and I was hoping maybe you could lean into that a little bit more about the distance between thought and speech and thought and language, that perhaps translation is also happening not just between people but within one person.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I believe so. I think one of the greatest challenges is as we write books, I mean, that's at least the challenge I take very seriously. What my desire when I'm writing is to bring experience into paper. And that's one of the most complicated, ethically challenging aspects of our trade. So what do we do with a language that belongs to everybody, to entire communities of practitioners? What do we do with that piece of language that we use, that we are trying to inhabit and work with, and with the experience of others? We are always talking, writing about others, even when we write about ourselves. It's once it is written down, it's another material right there, right? So that transition, thinking about that transition, accepting the challenge that thinking about that brings up, I think that's the most interesting and inescapable element of writing. We all tell stories. That's how we become social beings, right? But writers, I think, especially our, or at least what I see as my field, what makes me a writer, not only a storyteller, is to think precisely about that space that goes from experience to language, from experience into page. Because obviously, yes, the negotiation that we see more clearly in the translation in between two languages is always present in our relationship with ourselves, with language, the way in which we approach our material world, and the way in which we participate in what language does in terms of making all those experiences shareable. Mm. So I don't think of this as a minor element. I think that goes to the heart of writing. That's when writing becomes an ethical project and a political one as well, obviously.
Mm. Mm-hmm. You've before quoted Mireille Gancel's ideas about translation translations as transhumanists.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book, by the way.
It is.
Yeah. Great.
Some of those quotes you've said from her are that translation is both a risk taking and a continual reexamination. That translation is a learning to listen to the silences in between the lines, and that translation is the essence of hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
And you've also said that you are less interested in fidelity and more on what you call versioning, that instead of thinking of translation as a smooth transition or harmonious process, you look at how translation brings up dissent or discordance or deviation and the ways translation raises issues of power.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in hearing more about what you mean by versioning in light of this.
Yeah.
And in relationship to the Taiga Syndrome also.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, if we start to talk about the Taiga Syndrome, how happy I've been working with translators Jill Levine and Aviva Khanna. And I can tell you a number of stories about our conversations in regards to specific phrases and all that. It's been just a pleasure working with them. Jill is a legendary translator, and she's worked with many of the boom writers of the 60s and 70s, and I've been just so privileged in working with her. And I think that's something that we shared, our agreement that about translation not being necessarily these, as I put it there, a harmonious process, something that is going to inherently achieve some sort of peaceful agreement on things, right? But it's a possibility for us to take a look at various ways of looking at and approaching the world in which we live. And I think in that sense, translation allows us to generate a critical thinking and when in luck, a critical practice as well, right? My ideas about translation have changed dramatically ever since I started to translate myself. At the beginning, it was just the impulse when I really loved something and I thought that my friends in Mexico or in Latin America would benefit from, you know, specific poems or essays. I would just, out of love, I would try to translate. And then I've been more careful about, you know, picking my projects. But in doing that, I'm always interested in pieces of work that might, or in my view, will generate cross-border dialogues, and dialogues that I obviously think that are relevant for our life, for our political lives and our daily lives in whatever we live, right? And in that sense, I'm not as interested in issues of, as I said there, of fidelity. Of I mean, obviously, I want to capture what the core, the heart of the works that I'm interested in. But I think I'm always thinking in terms of the context, in terms of the larger conversation that I see them being part of. And in that sense, I'm talking about versions of, meaning that my activity as a translator is also informing the work and making that work something totally new in many ways, which has happened with these translators too. I've told Jill and Sarah Booker, the translator of the Iliad Crest, that what they've given me with these translations are new books that are new to me as well.
Yeah, and what's interesting about the books, obviously these are new versions of the same book, or not the same book, but versioning also sort of enters the plot of these books, I think, also. So one of the things that makes the Taiga Syndrome, I think, strange and wonderful is you've juxtaposed two different genres. And these two genres have, traditionally speaking, I think, have a different relationship to plot. And I think they also have a different relationship to sentence level syntax. Mm-hmm. So we have the detective genre, or the noir novel, and we have the fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And I think of versions and versions and versioning when I think of both of these aspects of the Taiga Syndrome. So on the one hand, we have a failed detective who's trying to write fiction based on her failed cases. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, she's versioning her own failed career. Mm-hmm. But then she comes out of retirement to pursue the case of a missing woman in the forest. So there's this sort of doubling back on the original text of her life. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, we have a man and a woman who disappear into the wilderness, into the unknown forest. And that's sort of the heart of many fairy tales, this story of a boy and a girl disappearing, and you do an explicit meditation on the versioning of fairy tales within the Taiga Syndrome. So you look at the quote unquote original versions of Hansel and Gretel and Little Red Riding Hood versus the more well known and more recent versions. So I was hoping maybe you could talk about some of the things that you see that were different in the original or older versions and the newer versions, and what the gap between those two was doing for you in terms of your meditation and in the Taiga Syndrome narrative.
You know, Forrest intrigued me greatly. And as most kids in, I guess, middle-class backgrounds, even if I didn't read, which I did, but if I hadn't read fairy tales, you know, childhood is informed by fairy tales in one way or another. That's the kind of societies, I think, that we are. And I think the detective, the noir, the genre, it's just so common to us. Even if you don't read them, you know how they work. And I think what I thought at the beginning when I was working on the territory on you know, the heart of this project, the Taiga Syndrome, I thought that if I really wanted to move as far away as possible, I needed to have something that was legible for myself and for readers. I didn't want to move in those places by myself alone. And I thought that it would be very useful to bring with me these genres that readers and people, generally speaking, understand and are familiar with. And so in that sense, recurring to these fairy tales, specifically these two, the Hansel and Gretel and the Caperucita Roja, were very useful in terms of creating a familiarity that may not, scare people that wanted to go with me to the limits of the forest. But at the same time, I wanted to think about a more contemporary forest, a forest in which exploitation is taking place, where labor is a major component of place, in which issues of sex and discrimination and stuff like that are also relevant elements of this forest life. And what I thought is that, capitalism, generally speaking, is her fairy tale. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to bring that, the ferocity of that mode of producing wealth, that and the great consequences that brings upon landscape and human life. So that was my forest. And what I thought is that the earlier versions of Hansel and Gretel, for example, are way more related and more explicit about all these different questions of accumulation than were later versions of these stories. And so I wanted to get to the heart of that, to that more obvious and bloodier and more complicated story, which I think, goes to the heart of many of our dilemmas, I think, in a world as we live in it.
Well, when you talk about wanting to make a contemporary forest, one of my favorite lines in the book is from the man who hires the detective to find the woman who left him, where he says, "This is not a fairy tale, detective." But then he goes on to add sort of dubiously, "This is a story about being in love." Mm-hmm. And of course, there's no story that's more mediated and more fairy tale like than the stories of love. And mm-hmm. I'm sure it sort of casts a light back on the fact that I'm guessing most people around love are in acting gestures that are informed by fairy tales.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in a contemporary way.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think that happens a lot with our major narratives. And I think creative writing is a way to explore the other side of these narratives and to make them more complicated, or as complicated as going through them is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the word taiga refers both to a place, the boreal forest, and also, so the boreal forest in the tundra of south of the tundra of Siberia, North America, mm-hmm. and also it refers to a syndrome,
mm-hmm.
A syndrome that occurs where certain inhabitants of the taiga suffer terrible anxiety attacks and make suicidal attempts to escape the taiga. So, given that it's both a place and a psychological
mm-hmm.
state,
mm-hmm.
In a response to a question about this, you answered that you think less about space as such and more about territory, which you describe as space plus politics. And
yeah.
I think maybe you touched on this already in the way that you're looking at, say, the works of the fairy tale of capitalism and accumulation within the forest. But could you talk a little bit more about the differences between territory and space?
Yeah, I've been reading a lot, and I'm very interested in recent works that have rightfully placed attention on our natural world, But I have also become very concerned about ways in which this seems to deflect attention about the many conflicts that this whole thing entails. And so at times I'm rather perplexed at the fact that we seem to be writing about nature as though nature is something that remains out there for our contemplation and our enjoyment or preoccupation, right? And I think we're inextricably linked. And in that very close organic relationship lies, many of the dilemmas that we're going through as contemporary society that we are. And so I just wanted to remind myself, at least, that whenever we talk about nature, whenever we talk about space, whenever we talk about landscape, we are, in fact, referring to a very conflicted areas of our social life. And these conflicts might be, you know, political, economic at heart, but are also metaphysical and spiritual, and they just crisscross all our experience and the way in which we conceive ourselves as agents of or participants in this whole context. And so I just think that writing is a way of, as I said earlier, complicating things or trying to share them in a way that is as complicated as we go through. Very often we don't have either the time or the predisposition to, we have to go through our life, right? We have to make things manageable, right?
Yeah.
But then we have books too. And in books, we're not going to resolve these issues, but at the same time, we might give the space so that these sort of multi-layered experience might bloom, might become as complex as they are. That's what concerns me when I'm writing. And that was a difference that I was trying to make in terms of space and territory.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Cristina Rivera Garza about her latest book in English, The Taiga Syndrome from Dorothy. I wanted to read another quote that you said, and it is, just as I write from and through a body among bodies, I do so in territories linked by economic inequality and cultural diversity. Am I addressing the question of accumulation? This is what I ask of my writing process. Am I attentive enough to issues of territory and embodiment? Answers to these questions not only generate different plot lines, but also encourage a wide array of formal explorations. I am increasingly interested in the material conditions that allow or don't allow the writing process, and I have tried to bring this interest as a motive, both in terms of plot and in terms of literary strategy in all my writing projects.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping maybe you could explain further both what you mean by the question of accumulation,
yeah,
and also what you mean by the material conditions that allow or don't allow the writing process, and any ways that might link into the bringing of the Taiga syndrome,
yeah,
into the world too.
Yeah. Usually, this is not always the case, but usually when you are in writing workshops, most of the attention goes to plot lines, creation of characters, dialogue, narrative arcs, things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking mostly about fiction right now.
Right.
But then it seems to me that when we started to pose questions about bodies in connection to other bodies, bodies and production, which is essentially the question about accumulation, right? I mean, what do we do in terms of producing the world in which we live? And how do we connect with others? And in what kind of vertical ways we do that? How are hierarchies created and all that? So once we start to think about that, I think it's very complicated to go back into these little boxes of, character and the psychology of the character and the dialogue and things like that. Not that they are not relevant or that are non-existent. Obviously, these are issues that we work with. These are our tools, the tools of our trade. But I think they become something else. Mm-hmm. And I'm very interested in this something else that they might become if we actually continue pressing these questions into the writing as such. Mm-hmm. I'm a reader of so-called experimental literature. I'm very interested in that kind of radical exploration of language and what it entails. I'm a reader of experimental literature from the United States, mostly from the West Coast. And one of the things that I become also concerned about is that at times those literary experiments seem to be done at the level of form, but not necessarily they are not necessarily reaching all these other questions that linked literature and writing to politics and to ethics. So I become way more interested in the kind of literary experimentation that takes into account how race and class and gender and linguistic diversity and accumulation and labor and work and all that kind of thing problematizes what we do. And what we do is that what we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, how it problematizes our relationship with language as practitioners of a language that we don't own, right? And as practitioners of languages that, at least in my case, I don't aspire to master as much as to work through. And it seems to me that once I get into that state of mind, I start to think about writing in a way that does not necessarily emphasizes the usual components of fiction, as I was listing those at the beginning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to return to this, the doubling of the psychic state, the taiga syndrome, and the geography, the taiga, in relationship to translation and versioning, and whether one can really separate psychic states from where one's body is in place. Mm-hmm. Which makes me think of a couple things either you have said or your narrator has said. You've mentioned something that Antoine Volodin used to say, that the ultimate end of books is to meddle with the dreams of the readers, thus forming a kind of dreamlike community, which I love.
Isn't that great? Yeah, I love it, yes.
And our narrator in the Taiga Syndrome says, we all carry a forest inside us, yes. The wilderness to which we are returning, the long way to becoming missing. We go to a place we imagined as foreign and find instead that we are home. Mm-hmm. The quote, which I love, makes me think of something that Ricky Ducournay said in her collection, The Deep Zoo, that the forest is the place human dreams come from, and that the paradox of the real is that a thing must be dreamed before it can be real.
Oh, that's a wonderful quote.
And this to me almost suggests that for a thing to be real, we must have a place that exists that resists our comprehension, a place of otherness where dreams can be born. Mm-hmm. So that the space where a dream is born is something that is almost not us, but then becomes us, which makes me wonder what happens to the real when we destroy the place of otherness. Mm-hmm. Which, in the case of fairy tales, is more often than not the forest. Mm-hmm. So when I think about the differences between, this is just me, pontificating or theorizing, but when I think about how the forest has become less bloody and less dangerous and less unknown in fairy tales, I wonder, does that correlate with the ways in which forests have become more humanized over time, or smaller and
or
more
dehumanized too.
Yeah, and dehumanized, but more managed in a way, so less completely resistant to our knowing them. Mm-hmm. But I was hoping you could speak to these questions that your narrator poses, which are: what is between imagining a forest and living in a forest? Mm-hmm. What brings together the writing of a forest with the lived experience of a forest?
This is just a wonderful take on these questions, which you just mentioned. And I just can't help but say, first of all, that what you have described as this place of unknowing, this place of where primeval questions arise, to me, that's writing. I mean, that's a place. That's my forest in many ways. I go to writing less because I know what I'm writing about, and more because I'm trying to explore things that I might be alive or bothering me in my intuition. But and then the writing is actually the searching for that. And not that I'm writing specifically to look for answers, as the saying goes, but just I have to go through the whole trajectory. I have to follow the thread of thought and to its ultimate consequences. And sometimes these consequences are not the production of knowledge, but the production of complicity, mm-hmm. the production of these, what you mentioned, the dreamlike connection with others that is not necessarily based on what we know, but what we might produced in just by way of contact. And that's something that we cannot know in advance, that we will know, if at all, when it's happening. And to me, that's just a description of what writing is. Mm. You know, that's there are books, entire books, that have shaped my life, and not only my intellectual life, but my life as such. And not necessarily because I understood what they were about, not because I got the message, but because they haunt me in all their openness. And that's the kind of book that I cherish, the ones that I keep with me, and the ones that I aspire to write. So that's the reason why Bolodin's quote is so relevant to me. I truly believe that when your book becomes a component of someone else's dreams, then you have achieved something.
Yeah.
Who cares about the reviews? Although I do like them.
Especially when they're good.
Yeah, when they're good, I love them. But once they become part of a person's dreams, then I really think that then you have achieved something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that as a potential aspiration.
Yeah, totally.
So I want to take a lot of what we've discussed and bring it to this question and the phenomenon of borders.
Yeah.
Because much of your work deals with this question of borders. And Sarah Booker, the translator of the Iliac Crest, she writes in her translator's note for the book that the Iliac Crest engages with borders between the North and the South, the living and the dead, male and female, fiction and reality, and lucidity and madness. And I feel like many of these polarities exist in the taiga syndrome too.
Mm-hmm.
But when I think of the taiga, the boreal forest, and taiga as a psychic, potentially as a dream space,
mm-hmm.
I also think of writing outside of fairy tales where the forest is a place not just of danger, but of transformation.
Yeah.
And it feels like that space has disappeared as forests have disappeared when I'm trying to link the taiga to the taiga syndrome. And I'm thinking about the role forests used to play even in non-fairy tale stories, like in 19th century American short fiction.
Of course.
You'd still see the forest and the wilderness as a place that everyday people would pass through.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a space, a non-human space. So like in a Nathaniel Hawthorne story, there weren't just the dangers of wolves or other animals, but there were also the dangers of humans breaking norms in those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So you might find people who go to the forest to operate under different rules than the town that they came from.
Mm-hmm.
That could be in some of his stories, for instance, someone performing a satanic ritual or witchcraft or something called witchcraft to further other whatever they're doing that's mm-hmm. different than what they do in their normal lives. So I wondered if human dreams come from the forest, and if something has to be dreamed for it to become real, if it is something about the borderlessness of forests, of actual forests and psychic ones, something mm-hmm. about the possibility of crossing borders and crossing norms that makes these spaces vital. And I guess I wondered about that in terms of, you're not just pushing people through borders of language, you're pushing people to the edges of human civilization in a mm-hmm. way. So mm-hmm. we're going to the margins of where humans live. And is there something about that, the seeking of a borderless space that mm-hmm. used to be, I think, almost narratively, architecturally part of the stories we used to
mm-hmm.
tell,
mm-hmm.
and now we find another way to do that, since mm-hmm. often people who are writing aren't having forests as part of their lives anymore.
Yeah.
But I want to hear a little bit about the pushing to the boundary of landscape, yeah. which mm-hmm. also then becomes a psychological pushing.
Yeah. You know, what this line, this question brings me to is the issues of margins. I think I've been always interested in what is happening, not at the center of things, but what is the consequence of whatever is happening in at the center of political discussions or economic growth or these other phenomenons. I'm interested in what is thought about, made into in these margins of society. I think the forest that we are being alluding to might be in another novel that I wrote earlier, No One Will See Me Cry, the peripheries of Mexico City in the early 20th century, for example, as a space that has been that is in alert and kind of responding critically to the decision making that takes place in downtown Mexico City, where the powers, when authorities are making the most of the decisions, and I just think that there is this energy and this possibility of criticism and rebellion, this possibility of insubordination, precisely in those areas that are less surveilled than others, and right now in the taiga is the forest, in the Ilia crest is that the ocean, the presence of the ocean and the border between the city of the north and the city of the south, and as I said, the insane asylum mm-hmm. in early 20th century Mexico. So in different ways, using different strategies and different levels of realism in all these stories, because as you've noticed, I've moved from some works that are based on documentary research to works that might reach the it's the fantastic, it's working within the contract of the fantastic. So but in all of them, I think what is common to all of them is this willingness to go to places that are not necessarily at the center of things. And I'm going there for that energy mm-hmm. and for that complication.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of your nonfiction books is an engagement with the work of Juan Rulfo.
Yeah.
And others, like the blurb that I mentioned at the beginning of Daniel Bozitsky, mention Rulfo in relationship to the taiga syndrome. And I did wonder about Rulfo's portrayal of the town Comala.
Yeah.
The real and the imagined town in relationship to your book. Do you see your real and psychic territory in the taiga syndrome to be in conversation with Pedro Páramo mm-hmm. or not so much?
Oh, by the way, you mentioned earlier about the material conditions of writing, and I think I didn't think I touched upon that, but the work that you're referring to, that book about Rulfo, had to do centrally with that question. I mean, how come this writer who was born in the provinces of Mexico was able to write these two wonderful books that so much marked literary history of modern Mexico, and instead of just in trying to answer that question, instead of just reading his works, which many people have done in wonderful ways as well, I went to do some research about his jobs and what these jobs allowed him to do or not to do, and the connection that these jobs created with government projects that had that were linked to processes of modernization in southern Mexico. So just to give you an idea of my Juan Rulfo,
yeah.
is not only my reading of Pedro Páramo, which obviously is one of the most important works of not only of Mexican literary history, but of literature written in Spanish, But at the same time, my relationship with Rulfo is mediated by all these considerations about the things that he had to go through and to do in order to be able to create that Comala, that city of the death, that place in which we are never sure if characters are dead or alive, that limbo, so to speak. And I would say that in that sense, there is the kind of point of view, the kind of perception that Rulfo inaugurates for Mexican literature, the attention to detail that is not, as he said, linked to any kind of a specific message. That's something that I totally shared with Juan Rulfo. That's something that I aspire to do in any case. I'm less interested in the aspects that views that portray him as this genius that somehow just appeared out of the blue.
Yeah.
And I'm more interested in ways of looking at Rulfo as a man of his times, with a body and a history, and a labor history that limited and allowed the literature that he created. So I think that that influenced the kind of relationship that he had with space and with geography. He was a agente de ventas. That's
a salesman?
Yeah, he worked for a tire company. And as such, he had to travel throughout the country, and he took pictures while doing that. And what I wanted to understand, usually you see, I don't know if you've been to these expos of Juan Rulfo's photographies. If you see them, they are beautiful. I mean, you would think that he is a photographer, which he was. I mean, he has that kind of eye and the technical expertise, and just the perspective of his gaze is just wonderful. But what I didn't want to forget while thinking about his work and the way in which he looked at the world is that he was doing that as an employee of either a private company, that like this Goodrich Euskadi company, or as an employee of the Mexican government, who was so radically and dramatically transforming specifically southern Mexico. He participated in something that was called a Comisión del Papaloapan, that had a lot to do with the displacement of entire indigenous communities in Oaxaca and in Mexico. So that adds complexity, ethical and political complexity, to Rulfo and his way of looking at the world. And I want that.
Yeah.
So it's not only this beauty that we see there in that black and white photography and that all these very interesting questions about death and life and, you know, suffering, but it's also that even more complicated relationship to Mexican government, Mexican agencies, and processes of modernization that ended up with entire communities and ways of life that are also Mexico.
Well, if we imagine that the reflexive way that people want to hold forth a canonical writer as a genius that comes out of nowhere, mm-hmm. particularly male writers, I think more than women. How was this received? Given how cherished he is, yeah. I would think that perhaps it was unwelcome to some quarters to peek behind the curtain and make him more complex. I mean, I think perhaps there are people who cherish it not being complex, to cherish this sort of magical being who descended down to the typewriter and made this incredible book.
You know what Marguerite Yourcenar used to say about love? That it was better to love with your open eyes. And that's when I started to see some of these reception of the book, specifically by Una Fundación, the Juan Rulfo Foundation. Mm. They were very uneased by this book. And what I said is, this is love. I mean, I love his work, and it's been so important to me, but I'm willing to love him with my open eyes.
Yeah.
And I don't think that adding complexity to an author that you cherish is, there is nothing bad about that. I mean, it's just as I said, you add a different layer, you ask an uncomfortable question, and you get uncomfortable answers. But that's what we do as writers. Can you imagine if we were only asking the questions that are going to be appeasing our world? What kind of writers would we be?
Well, as a sort of a final question, I wanted to ask you about a question about fiction versus nonfiction for mm-hmm. you. Because the Taiga Syndrome was your last book of fiction.
Yeah.
Published in Spanish in 2012. And since then, you've written multiple books of documentary nonfiction, which haven't yet been translated into English. And you've wondered if you want to write fiction anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to hear about that, because your fiction does engage with many real concerns in the nonfictional world. It deals with borders and immigration, with psychiatry and gender, with femicide and sexual violence, the marginalization of women and women artists. So what made you feel like remaining in the fictional realm with these topics was no longer satisfactory?
It's been something that has troubled me for a while too. You remember what Karl Ove Knausgård said about fiction? I kept it with me for a long time. He said that in a world in which pretty much everything has become fiction, the real power of fiction has radically diminished. And I think in many ways that's true. What can fiction do in a world in which you have caravans of people trying to cross the border and asylum rights are being denied to them? What can fiction do in terms of all these women who are right now denouncing countless instances of sexual violence against them, perpetrated on daily basis in homes and offices in Mexico and pretty much everywhere else? So very often I become frustrated. I'm rendered frustrated by, you know, the way in which we live. And obviously I have, as many have done, I have to interrogate my own privilege and my access to language and printing and this conversation and everything else. But then one time, during my most troubled stage about fiction, I was teaching this workshop at UCSC when I was back then a professor, and I just started my class by asking them very honestly, and I said, this is not a rhetorical question, I wanted to hear your answers. Is fiction relevant to you? And these were, like, I don't know, it was a huge class. It was an intro to fiction class. I had about 100 students in that place.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was just very disarmed. I wanted just to know their opinions. And it was just wonderful to see them. They came up with the usual, you know, how fiction allows us to be on the shoes of others and how it creates empathy and how it allows to tell stories that otherwise the authorities or the powers that be might not let go through. And, you know, as usual, as all these answers were, they were also very hopeful to me. Hmm. And so I've been right now I'm working on a book that is half fiction and it originally it was a work of nonfiction, but then something has happened to me and I think that conversation that I have with my students at UCSD was a departure, a new departure for this reconnection to fiction. Right now I'm writing this work that has to do is an exploration of a very, very real historical process that took place on the border between Texas and Tamaulipas. It's a cotton process, a cotton project that developed in the 1930s as many Mexicans were coming back. They were forced, they were expelled from the United States, and they became deportees and were trying to make their lives right there on the border. And many Mexicans from southern Mexico were also migrating up north looking for better conditions of life. So my family took part on this social experiment of Cardenismo in the 1930s. And so I wanted at the beginning to document the story and to tell it in a nonfiction type of way. But then there were many things that I couldn't answer I couldn't even touch by doing that. And so fiction slipped through found its way back. Mm. And right now, we were talking about being a host or a guest. Right now, I think fiction is the host of the story. And I'm quite pleased by that. It's not the same kind of fiction that I was writing before. I went through my whole turmoil and my whole questioning. It is a fiction that is showing the process, as you know, what I went through, but it's still fiction. Yeah. with its power for empathy and its power for connection, and it's the possibility that it gives us to see ourselves in others. And I think at this point in time in these countries, I think that's one of the most important political leaps that we are allowed, and I'm glad the fiction is there for us to do that.
Well, it was a great pleasure having you on the show.
Thank
Christina.
You. No, thank you so much. I really enjoy the questions. Thank you for the conversation.
We were talking today to Christina Rivera Garza about the Taiga Syndrome from Dorothy Books. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is the news at noon.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host The Bail Trap on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Bail Trap features short films and speakers on bail fees in the United States. Money bail is one of the main causes of mass incarceration in the United States. Low-income Americans are sitting in jail for days, months, and even years, simply because they cannot afford to pay high bail amounts. Films include Breaking Down, Deal with the Devil, How Much is Your Freedom Worth, and more. Again, that's The Bail Trap on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
May 16th, 2019. In national news, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York has announced it will no longer accept donations from the Sackler family because of the family's direct involvement in the opioid epidemic. The Sacklers are one of the richest families in the U.S. with a combined net worth of over $13 billion. The Sackler family held extensive control over the distribution of OxyContin through their private company, Purdue Pharma. Since its release, overdoses relating to OxyContin have killed an estimated 200,000 Americans, according to the Center for Disease Control. In more national news, this morning a majority Republican Missouri State Senate passed a bill restricting abortions after 8 weeks. The bill will now head to